Daniel and everyone over at the Extreme Podcast, former WWE superstar Hornswoggle here. I wanted you guys to make sure to check out this podcast. Wrestling, movies, video games, everything nerdy. Hope all goes well.
Hey guys, thank you for tuning into the Extreme Podcast. I'm your host, Daniel. And in this episode, I spoke with Terry Kozlowski about her book, Life Coaching, Her Clan, History, and Culture. I hope you guys enjoy this episode. I really enjoyed speaking with Terry, and I hope you guys enjoyed listening to the episode as much as I enjoyed speaking with her. So, in the description, I will put links to her book, a link to a free checklist, and her website so that you guys can go show some support and check out some of her stuff as well. Also, we've got some cool things coming up. Bandai America is going to be on next week, and we're also going to have a charity stream next month, so keep an eye on Facebook, Twitter, for information about that as well. It is going to be for the Trevor Project, and I hope you can join us. So without further ado, I will see you guys on the flip side.
My name is Terry Kozlowski, and I am a writer. Author of Raven Transcending Fear is my book, which came out in February of this year. I'm also a fellow podcast host. My podcast is called Soul Solutions, where we dive deep for about 15 minutes. It's a solo show on different areas that will help you walk away with tangible things to do to help you overcome your fears and limiting beliefs. And that is where my what I call soul coaching comes from. I'm a life coach, certified life coach, and I specifically want to work with people who have some deep-seated trauma that they need to overcome. But also, a lot of people have issues setting personal boundaries. They have issues with understanding what their limiting beliefs are and who they authentically are. So I am a firm believer that we all come to Earth School already knowing exactly who we are. We come into this world as our authentic self, and it is through our loving parents that we become something that we weren't supposed to be. That starts it because we are very impressionable, and we get told when we are 3, 4, 5, 6 to be good girls and good boys and shh, don't say that. All those things that when we are being our authentic selves, that we're trying to navigate the world, and that all of that gets shut down. And then, of course, we get into school, and you have that lovely thing called peer pressure where you want to fit in, and your ego mind is forming and trying to say, oh, I want to be their friends. If I have to be their friends, that means I need to be this, and I need to do that, and I can't be this. And all those things that we love, we change for others. And then we go through our lives and conform to be accepted. And in about our late 30s, mid 40s, we have a life crisis of some sort, midlife crisis. And that is when we finally realize, dang, I really don't like who I am because I'm not being authentically me. I'm tired of wearing these masks and labels and armors I've put on for very good and different reasons. But we also tend to operate on, I was operating on Terry 1.0 for way more time than I needed to be where I should have been at. You know, I think every decade we need a new software update. So I should be on Terry 5.0 now. And I think I am. I think I'm there. And I think all of us don't realize that whatever mindsets that we get when we are 10, 11, 12, 15, they don't change in how we deal with others when we're in our 20s, and they get modified even more. And then as we keep operating on 1.0, or if we're lucky, 2.0, it still doesn't help us when we get into our 30s and 40s and 50s, where we're still thinking that we are not lovable, or that we're unworthy, or we can't do something, or we always dreamed of being an artist, and yet our art teacher told us we weren't any good, so we put down our paintbrushes instead of doing art for art's sake, doing art because that's what we want to do. That's part of who we authentically are, and that's how part of our creative process. So that's a little bit of who I am. The book itself is really about my trauma recovery. So I was sexually abused when I was 11 years old. My mother allowed three men to, she sold my innocence so she could have drugs. She was an alcoholic and drug addict. And then physically abandoned my sister and I on the streets of Albuquerque, New Mexico. When I was 11, she was 10, 3,000 miles away from home. So I had to figure out a way to get my sister and I back to Pennsylvania, which is where my dad was. So that is my trauma story. And there is of course, a switch to survivor story, and then a living a full life and being very happy with my authentic self.
Gotcha. I'll have to read that. That sounds, it's an interesting story. It baffles me. Like I get like the whole get addiction, but like just certain things in life, like when people let their addiction take over, it baffles me that it can go so far. Just because I've experienced things personally when I was younger. Like my mom got addicted to some things, and she's turned her life around now, but you know, seeing it firsthand, I don't get it. Cause I try not to let anything do that to me. If that makes sense.
It does.
My biggest addiction is probably video games, to be honest with you.
But there's a difference between addiction to a substance where they lose who they are. And my mother lost who she was. And because of the addiction, she was hiding. Most people who are addicted specifically to substances, whether it is food, alcohol, drugs, you know, whatever that substance, cigarettes, whatever that is, they're trying to squelch down pain. They're trying to cover up pain. And when we don't deal with our pain, it amplifies and it keeps growing. And not only that, it grows only in our mind because we're so focused on it. When we actually start looking for solutions instead of looking at our suffering is the only time that they can actually come out of the addiction and see that there is potential life for them outside of that pain. And my mother was an alcoholic, I think from the time she was 16 years old until her death. And she never was able to come out of that pain. And sadly, a lot of people in this world live in a continuous state of trying to squash some sort of pain. And I understand that, you know, being a trauma victim myself, I understand why we focus so much on that. And part of that is our egoic mind. Our mind or ego has a purpose and it's meant to protect us. And when something bad happens to us, especially when we're children, it goes into overdrive to try to protect us. The problem with that is that we never get our software upgrades because we stay focused on 1.0 and that suffering and that pain. And the ego never learns that because this bad situation happened here doesn't mean it will continually happen the rest of my life. And the ego focuses on things like that because it's meant to protect us. You know, when we were, you know, aboriginals and cavemen and all that good stuff, it was very, very important whether or not we knew if a bear or a tiger or a lion or, you know, a creature could be harming us. A bobcat could be harming us while we're out hunting and gathering. It's a whole different thing nowadays when most of us aren't, you know, hungry because we have access to food. We have shelter. We have all those things that the ego was meant to help us be safe from. So since we have all that, what does the ego need to focus on now? It finds other things. It says it focuses on, for me to be accepted, I have to look a certain way. For me to be loved, I have to be worthy of love. That's what it decides to focus on. You know, Joe the other day made a nasty comment to me during a meeting. Now I don't want to go in today's meeting because Joe's going to be there. That's not something the ego really needs to be concerned about. You know, if you were in the pathway of Ida, you needed to be concerned about that. Your ego going into overdrive there probably was a good thing. But for most of us on a day in, day out basis, you know, the ego can be put aside. You can say, thank you for letting me know that that is a concern. I feel perfectly safe because, you know, I'm 1,000 miles away from Ida, whatever it is, you know, whatever that angst that you have, whatever that fear is that you have that the ego puts in place, to keep you living a small life, to keep you from taking a risk and trying new things, to keep you in what it wants and what it causes us to think as safe.
That's true. I've never thought of it necessarily that way, but like, and especially like growing, you know, the more I get older, I used to like bottle up everything. And then at a certain point it would just go. But what I've started to try to do is to let it out slowly so that it doesn't bottle up. But if you, I guess I see that, like, if you have that substance problem and you're just pretty much like almost like a server, you're putting a mask on in mm-hmm. front of somebody. I could see. Yeah.
Well, I'm trying to use analogies your audience will understand. So
yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Yeah.
But the other part of that is when we look at the way we interact with others, and most children are not taught how to properly deal with their emotions. What happens when you see a kid throwing a hissy fit? You know, our reactions to them is settle down, calm down. Yep. Let it out. Let them let it out. Most of the time, they're not having an issue. They're not causing a problem. If they're not hurting themselves, go ahead and let them. My son, which he'll hate me telling this story on air. My son, when he was 3 years old, we were in the grocery store and he wanted some snack. And I said no, because he already picked two snacks. He could get two snacks. And he picked the two snacks and he wanted a third. And I said no. And he got on the floor and his little legs and arms were going. He's screaming. And I'm letting you do this. Everybody in the grocery store is moving away from him. And I leaned down and I said, "Do you see the other people watching you?" And he's is still screaming and looking around, you know, checking things out. And he calmed himself down and he stopped. And he never did that again in the grocery store. Now, he would do that at home, but I wasn't trying to stop him from letting out the emotions. I was trying to get him to verbalize what was wrong. Tell me why you're upset. You know, tell me in words. Don't be screaming and ranting like that. But most of us aren't taught that. And if you come from a substance abuse home, the thing you are taught is to stuff your emotions, because that's what that's what the other substance abusers are doing. They're stuffing their emotions. They're not letting them out. So for me, learning how to let my feelings out was really hard because I didn't have a really good example for it. Number one. And number two, what happens if it's a negative feeling? You know, when you look at the world, you see angry people, very vocal, angry people, or you see those of us who silently suffer in quiet. And there's really no in between. You don't see people getting their righteous indignation. And there's a reason it's called righteous indignation. You don't see people getting righteous indignation and standing up for a cause without all that anger and all. Having righteous indignation means that you are standing your ground for a point you're trying to make from a rational and loving place. If you come from a place of anger, that's fear. Anger is fear in public that's acceptable. It's not anything, you know. I think there's only two emotions. There's love and there's fear. And everything comes out of those two emotions. All our decisions that we make in life come from a place of love or come from a place of fear. All our decisions we make come from a place of love or a place of fear. The choices we make, are we going to buy this house or that house, really comes down to what are we most fearful of? Are we most fearful of looking bad to others? Or are we most fearful of being, you know, in a different part of the neighborhood that we don't know anybody? What causes us more fear? You know, I like this neighborhood better, but I don't know anybody here. By the way, that's where I ended up moving. I ended up moving where I knew nobody because the community and what it offered me was more important than being around the people that technically I was meant to move away from. I think the universe, the way it works with me is when it's time, when I am done learning all I can learn from a group of people, it literally plucks me up and puts me somewhere else. And every time in my life that I've needed to have a major shift, the universe plucked me up and moved me away.
I want to go backtrack it just a quick second. Your book, where are you able to get it, and how much is the book?
You can go to Raven. Yeah, you can go to raventranscendingfear.com. It's available on Amazon for $9.99. I believe the ebook is $5.99. So it's affordable for everybody, and which was something I really wanted, because the reality is it's not a long book. You know, it's about 150 pages. It's not a long book. It's meant to be, you're meant to be able to read it in one sitting. But what I can say is most people that have read it haven't been able to. And what I mean by that is I either have people who knew me personally who couldn't read it because they were upset this happened to me. And then I, other than those who have gone through trauma, have to do it in steps because it causes them to relive certain things. It brings out emotions in them that they don't want to deal with necessarily. And so there, you know, I do caution people who have gone through trauma that you need to take it in steps, you know, and pretty much there are six chapters. So you do the first two, the second two, you know, you do it in sets of two. And because part of each of those chapters, you're dealing with something. And what I mean by that is it's understanding why you're feeling the way you do, why it is, you know, I went through suicidal thoughts. I went through where people thought that I was anorexic. There was all kinds of things other people imposed upon me that I had to deal with, let alone all those thoughts going through my head. And, you know, understanding what monkey mind is and understanding how to change that. And then as you go through the healing process, you know, learning to set personal boundaries, that's something else you probably weren't taught as a child. Not many of us are as children taught how to set personal boundaries, because with parents, there are no personal boundaries, right? You know, but that's not true, because I was 28 years old when somebody said to me, you know, because I grew up in the church. So honoring thy mother and thy father was really important. It was something we had to do. And then at 28, I had somebody tell me, yes, you are to honor your mother and father, but that doesn't mean they're allowed to hurt you. Wow, that's profound. But the reality is, why would we ever think it's okay for our parents to harm us? Because they're from, you know, there's child abuse laws. Even as adults, why do we allow our parents to verbally abuse us or to belittle us in ways that if it was anybody else on the planet, we would defend ourselves, but not with mom and dad. So it's understanding what those personal boundaries are and learning to put them into place. And the hardest one I had to deal with was putting it into place with my mother. And because she would call most of what I recall from being 11 until the last phone conversation I had with my mother, which was 6 years before she passed, was basically her blaming me for all that went wrong in her life. I was the reason she was an alcoholic, even though she drank before I was born. I was the reason my parents divorced. I was the reason for all these things. And when you are 11, when you are 7, 8, 9, 10, 12, 15, 18, 24, you may believe that because there is no proof otherwise. It wasn't until I realized that, no, she's just projecting that upon me, because she was these things before I was ever born. She did have problems. She did have pain. All of this underlying issues that she had all occurred before, you know, I was an inkling in her womb. So because I was able to start seeing, okay, she's just projecting, that isn't, it isn't my fault. I could start taking off some of that blame. And I, first personal boundary I put up was she wasn't allowed to call me if she was drunk. And if she did, I would hang up on her. And the first time it happened, I hung up on her. And I, that was when phones were plugged into the wall. And I unplugged the phone from the wall and crashed to the, slithered to the floor in tears. Because it was the hardest thing that I ever had to do was that. And after about the third time, she quit calling me drunk. But it, you know. But standing and maintaining those personal boundaries can be very difficult.
I would say, you know, standing your ground, that's the hardest thing. Like my mind, for some reason, I don't know why it does this, but it always goes in like 20 different directions. It's like, this could happen, this could happen, this could happen. And like, the hardest part for me to, for anything really in life, is just to sticking down that one road and not trying to veer off somewhere else and be like, maybe just this one time I'll talk, or, you know what I mean? Like, that's my hardest thing that I'm working on, but
I can give you a clue to help you with that. Ready? If you start thinking, what if this happens and what if that happens, all of that, if any of that involves somebody else, that they have to do something, most likely it's not going to happen. And the reason I say that is that was one of the things. What if I hung up on my mother, she would call back. Well, I could unplug the wall, unplug the phone from the wall, and then even if she tried calling back, I wouldn't have to deal with it. And I found solutions for that. So what happens if she keeps calling? You know, I plug the phone back and she keeps calling. Well, then unplug the, don't let her know, tell her again and unplug the wall. But if I, any time that I thought, okay, well, if I say this and this person does this, as soon as it went to, if I have to rely on another person to do something, the likelihood is that's only happening in my mind. That other person isn't going through all 20 scenarios that I'm just played out in my mind, you know? So the likelihood is if I'm making more of a deal of whatever it is than the other person. So if you're relying on that other person to say this or to do that, or to react in a way because you're upset, guess what? I was upset my mother was calling me drunk. She wasn't upset she was calling me drunk. Yeah. She was just doing what she wanted to do. And we that start thinking that how we feel is coming from the other person. And it's never that way.
Good way to look at it.
Mm-hmm.
So your mission as a life coach, would you like to go into, I guess, what you're trying to get out of being a life coach and helping other people?
I want everybody to understand that they are worthy just as they are, and that they need to love and accept themselves just the way they are. And most people have limiting beliefs because they're still operating on 1.0 software. And if they really looked at the whys of things, they're looking at the wrong question. So I stayed in my suffering for decades because I kept wanting the answer to that age-old question, why me? And when we try to find out the why did my mother allow this? Why did my mother abandon us? When we look for the why, we stay attached and trapped in the past. Do we not? Isn't that where the, because that wherever that answer is coming from, it's coming out of the past. It's not coming out of the present moment. It's not coming in the future. It's coming out of the past. Why did this happen to me in the past? And I got to the place where I finally realized, would I accept any answer that my mother could possibly give me for why? And the answer is no. There is no why that would be acceptable because, you know, because I didn't love you. Well, that's still not acceptable for the behavior she and the harm she caused me. She wanted drugs. That's still not an acceptable. There is no acceptable answer to the why question. So when I realized that the why question was keeping me stuck to the past, I is moved to a new question. Now what? All of this did happen. All of this did suck. This was a lousy childhood. Yes. But now what? And when I switched to the now what question, it was about me taking control of my present, which was also me taking control of where my future was going instead of staying tied to the past. Depression, in my opinion, is staying tied to the past. Because you are fearful of the past and you are depressed. If you are fearful of the future, you are anxious. So the depending on where, but in the present moment, right now, you're not fearful. We're having a nice conversation and there's nothing to be afraid of. And so in the present moment, all our fears melt away. So living in the past, you're depressed. Living in the future, you're anxious. So why not stay living in the present? Why do we allow our egoic minds to take us somewhere that we can't live anyway? You can't live in the future and you can't live in the past. You have to live in the present moment. So stay focused, be present. And almost 99% of the time, the present moment is perfectly fine and safe.
Very true. Something you said too, like, I love your analogy of like the software update because it makes a lot of sense, especially because like when you think about it, as you're going through life and you learn things or like are trying to figure out how to deal with things, especially like you said, our parents don't always teach us the right way to handle a situation or something. I've had moments in my life where I'm like, I probably shouldn't have went that route. But at the same time, in a way, I'm kind of glad I did because it's made me who I am. But I like that thought process because it's, if you update your computer, for example, within that first month, sometimes that update can be a little rocky and it can take things backwards a little bit, but eventually it smooths out over time and becomes a better program or system for it. So like that analogy, I think it's a really neat analogy.
If you really look at the lessons you learn, if you really truly learn the lessons of your teens, then your 20s should be better. But you're also, that means your mindset has to change from being, you know, lots of times it's a peer pressure thing and we're trying to do and be everything for everybody that wants us to grow up and be these fabulous people. We get in our 20s and we realize, okay, what do I like? What I don't like? Is this working for me? Is this not working for me? And if we choose to be our authentic selves and do what we want to do, not necessarily from a selfish place, but that we want to help the world in this way and we're passionate about doing it, then keep growing and expanding in that area. And when you grow and expand from a soulful place, then the passion in your life continues on and you don't get in the, you know, I know lots of people who mommy and daddy wanted them to become accountants. So that's what they did, but they hate math. You know, so they're suffering day in, day out at their job. They're making good money. They're CPAs. They're doing well, but they hate it. Why in the world would you want your child to hate what they do the rest of their life? Technically, that's not what parents want. And when your children find those things that they're passionate about or they really enjoy, let them enjoy it and figure out a way if they can earn a living doing that. And a lot of us, you know, my dad wanted me to go to business school. And that's what I did. And about 2 years in, I hated it. And I went to my daddy in tears, telling him how much I hated. And he looks at me and says, but honey, if you didn't want to do it, you didn't have to do it. And part of me is like, but you really, you know, what I wanted, I said what I wanted to do. I wanted to become a speech pathologist, but you said, no, you shouldn't do that. You're only going to work in the hospital. You're only going to make $30,000 a year. And now they're everywhere in the school system and the hospital system. And all the baby boomers who are having strokes or having speech pathologists work with them. And that is what I wanted to do. On average, they make $80,000 a year. And I could have been doing that. That's what I wanted to go to school for. But I did what my daddy wanted me to do. And that is where I talk about we get squashed. So I'm still helping people. It's in a different way. And 2 years into it, I had so much accounting and economics that I do have a minor in both accounting and economics. But I also have a minor in history and sociology. And I have a Bachelor of Science in Social Sciences is what my degree is in. So I ended up getting the degree, not the business one that my daddy wanted me to. But that business background has helped me in my career. But it's definitely something that we put upon our children, and we pressure them into things that maybe they don't want. Maybe we want to live vicariously through them. And, you know, I wanted my kids to go to college. And my son went into college and wasn't the place for him. He is not a good test taker. And what do you do in college? It's all you do in college. You study on your own and you take tests. So it was not the environment for him. He ended up going into the military. He went through trade school program with the military and he loves his job. So, you know, I'm happy for him. And he's going to make way more money than if he did a college degree in computer science. So, you know, Let them find their path. You can influence and make suggestions, but make those suggestions from a place of love, not from a place of financial gain, or, you know, really look at what your child really enjoys. And, you know, even if it's video games, you can encourage them in ways that you love video games and you're a good artist. Maybe look at graphic design and you can, you know, make the graphics for video games. Or if you really like computers, there, you know, maybe you could come up with new computer chips or audio sounds. You know, there's all kinds of things that you can do for the gaming industry besides play, and that they make a lot of money.
Yes. That's kind of where I'm at. So I have 3 classes left for college. I did it stupid though. I took all the classes that I enjoyed first.
Ah.
And now I'm left with, and I took a break, and then, you know, the whole pandemic stuff happened. I got a new car, and my grandpa helped me pay off the school debt so that I could get the car, because nobody wanted to help me with a loan for the car.
Mm-hmm.
It was just a mess. Now I'm like, because it's math, which I'm the way that they're doing math, at least at the college I'm going to. So you'll take the lessons, and if you fail the test, you have to start back where at the beginning of the lesson from where you didn't pass on the test. And I was like, I can't do it. Like, it's just like, I just keep going back.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the test that I 100% feel that, because like that's where I'm at.
Mm-hmm.
And the sucky thing is like, I want to finish it because I've already put so much time and money into it.
Yeah.
But just that knowing that like I've tried their math classes and I always get stuck back at the beginning. Like, that's the part that's hard for me, because then I'm going back into debt to fail a class.
Yeah,
the classes I know I can pass, like the other classes, history and psychology or sociology or something, one of those two.
Psych 101.
Yeah. So I'm like, those ones I could probably pass, because I enjoy history to an extent. Like, there's certain parts of history I could fall asleep to. And then I've never actually took psychology, but I've heard that it's fun.
Yeah, so it helps you understand people better. That's part of what that is, understanding different people better. But my suggestion to you would be, go ahead and take those 2 classes and then go to your counselor and say, look, this is the one class, you see I've taken it. So that I've, you know, this is something I'm having issues with. How do you suggest I finish this last class? And see what options they give you. I did things a little differently. I didn't want to do public speaking. I did all my other classes. Public speaking I did last semester that I was in college is when I took public speaking. Now, because I also graduated in 3 years. So I went full-time all the time. So in 3 years, I got my degree instead of 4. So that last semester, since I knew the professor, I had had him in other classes before, and I was the oldest person class, even though I was still, you know, 20, I was still, because everybody takes speech 101 their freshman year, normally first semester. I decided I was going to do that a little differently, and it worked to my benefit. I aced the class. The professor tells you at the beginning of the class, nobody ever gets an A in this class. I was the first A that he ever gave in that class. So, you know, sometimes waiting that little bit will do 2 things. 1, build your confidence, and 2, allow you to come in with a different viewpoint, different perspective, because perspective really is everything. In whether you succeed or you fail is based on your perception, how you walk into the situation.
And that's the thing too, is like, I'm kind of at the point where I'm like, so like I took, what I went for is graphic design, because I'm like, almost every field uses that. So I feel like it's a good skill to know, and it's fun. I enjoy it. But the part like of me, like, so to go back into that situation, I'm just like, I know it's going to happen. I know I'm going to do it eventually. But like, I have almost going back to that peer pressure thing. Like, some of my family and friends are like, you need to go back and do it. And I'm like, I don't feel that pressure anymore. I'm like, I'll go back when I'm ready. Cause like, I know if I go back before I'm ready, I could just be back to where I'm at now.
And really and truly, you have to make that call. And having other, you know, if it's one thing to say, this is what I'm feeling, this is where I am, you know, do you have any suggestions for me? But otherwise, if you're not asking for suggestions, then people shouldn't be offering suggestions.
True.
And I take that very seriously because, you know, we all want support in whatever it is we're doing. And if you want to continue having your podcast and monetize your podcast and then continue doing your digital arts, people should support you in doing that. If you decide I'm going to go ahead and finish my degree, people should support you in that. And really and truly, those people who love and care about you, that's what they're going to do. Whether they personally agree that that is the best way that they think you should use your time is irrelevant.
So I wanted to take this, I got this like last question bulletin about your history, your clan, your culture. I figured that'd be a fun thing to talk about. As I talked to you off air, I've always been interested in that stuff because of my great, great grandpa. So
my mother was a 100% Native American from a little town called Fort Yukon, Alaska. It's 8 miles inside the Arctic Circle. You can only get there by plane or up the Yukon River. There are no roads to Fort Yukon. And she was born there in the 40s, and it was sustenance living at that time. There was no running water. There was no electricity. And during the Cold War, the Army came in and set up a listening station for Russia. And that's what caused Fort Yukon to kind of come into being. They ended up with a little airport and some municipal buildings because of the military. And my mother, at the age of 16, was given up for adoption by her mother. Her mother had, her husband had died in a flood, and she had 16 children at the time. In Fort Yukon, Alaska, in the wintertime, there's only 3 hours of what is kind of dusky light outside, and it's cold. It's 50 below zero in the wintertime, and that is without a wind chill. So it's very cold. So they do lots of cuddling in Alaska. And so she had 16 siblings. She was the oldest girl, and the three oldest girls were given up for adoption. They were put on an airplane that they had never been on before and flew to Olympia, Washington State, where a missionary couple, Christian couple, adopted them, the three girls. And from the adoptive parents' point of view, they were taking these three girls, all teenagers at the time, and giving them a better life. They were going to go to better schools. They were going to dress in pretty dresses and have their hair done, and all those things that white culture puts upon others. And my mother always talked about coming to the white man's world. That was her derogatory statement that she used. And she always told my sister and I we were Native American. But because of the fact that she was yanked away from it the way she was, and the first night she spent in Olympia, Washington, she was turning on and off the light switch, watching the light go down, and flushing the toilet, watching the toilet water go down, because they hadn't had any of those conveniences before. But soon after she arrived, her belongings were taken away from her because, you know, they were, although they were not up to her adoptive parents' standards, that was their stuff. That's who they were. They spoke a different language. They weren't allowed to speak that language anymore. And so who they authentically were was ripped away from them. And it was all done from a place of love. And this is where when you see children who have been adopted from other cultures, as I think it's very important that you allow those children to explore their culture and you provide them with ways to do that. Whether, because when they look at you, they're not looking at themselves in the mirror. You know, my mother was looking into these very oval shaped, because she was a very round shaped face, darker skin, black hair, very Native American looking. And she's looking into the face of these loving white people who wanted to take care of her and her sister. But she became an alcoholic by the time she was 18. She married my dad, who literally was on his way to Vietnam and thought somebody should get his death benefit because he didn't believe he was coming back alive, and married my mom. And that's, you know, that's how they started their marriage. When I was little, she always talked about being Native American, but I never really understood what that meant. And when I was 7 years old, I came home from school all upset because I was being, kids were making fun of me because I have almond-shaped eyes and they were calling me a Chinka girl. I wasn't upset that they were calling me names, which a lot of people really seem not to understand. I was trying to correct them and tell them, no, I wasn't Oriental. I was Native American. And they weren't listening. They weren't taking the change that I was trying to, they weren't taking the correction. And I was upset about them not taking the correction. My mother's reaction was completely over the top. And that's why it's so imbued in my memory. She was ranting and raving how, you know, the white man took everything away from us Native Americans and imposing their culture and all this stuff. So I knew that being Native American was really important, but I didn't know what that was. She didn't teach us about the culture. And it wasn't until I got into high school and college that I started learning about the Athabascan Indians, who were the ones that crossed over the Bering Strait and actually settled in northern Alaska and Canada, Yukon territories. And then they have tribes. And there's the Tlingit tribe and the Haida tribe, all these different tribes. And my tribe is the Tlingit tribe. And my clan is the Raven clan, hence Raven transcending fear. That's where the Raven imagery comes from. And from that Raven, in the book, I the beginning of the book talks about the culture. And the Raven has great historical significance all through history, all through different mythologies, whether it's from Greek or the Bible or Druidism, Celtic, all of that, Native Americans have symbolism concerning the Raven. And the main one that most people immediately see is some sort of association with death, due to Edgar Allan Poe, made that quite famous. But the reality is, the reason that there's imagery with ravens at death is because the raven is there symbolizing the transcendence from this plane to the next plane. So they're there to take the spirit to the next plane. So it's a very spiritual sense. And a lot of people don't realize that Noah actually released the raven first, not the dove. And the raven didn't come back because the raven is very resourceful and found a place to live. But the other thing with the ravens is that for the Tlingit tribe is the raven brings the light to humanity. And I really grabbed a hold of that when I was going through my healing process and the healing journey that I was taking in my teens and early 20s, was that the raven brought me the light and transcended me from a place of fear and darkness into a place of love and light. So that's where that imagery comes from and where the raven symbolism comes from in the book. But as far as the tribe today, they're still, you know, I still have family living in Fort Yukon, Alaska, still 8 miles inside the Arctic Circle. They have a school and they have churches. It's interesting because when they have what's called a potlatch, and potlatch is a Native American celebration of foods, and a gathering of the peoples. And part of what happens there is traditional stories get passed down. And when I did go to a potlatch with my mother, she had been away for 40 years and went back for the first time. And her brother, when we got to Alaska in Fairbanks, had a potlatch for her. And some of those foods that I had never eaten before, included rabbit and muskrat, and moose head soup was something else that I had. And the moose head soup was really good. It had moose meat in it, but what's inside a moose's head? Brains.
Oh, yeah, brains. Yeah,
you're brains. Right. So I'm eating the moose head soup, and my cousin leans over and says, "What do you think about the moose head soup?" I said, "It's really good. The noodles are too mushy." And he said, "It's not noodles." Oh, now I know what this is. Okay. Now I ate it. It was mushy noodles. This is what I thought they were, but you know, I ate it. So, and it was, it's really interesting because they use a lot of fruit with their meat.
That's funny that you say that, because I'm like, I like to try different foods from different cultures and stuff. Like my friend, she's from Cambodia, and I went to her house and she had these like really spicy noodles, and I didn't know that. So I just was like thinking it was like a spaghetti type thing.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I regretted it. I was like on fire. But like that's some of the stuff, like, is like, I love trying different foods and stuff, but sometimes I don't know. I don't want to know what's inside of it.
And a lot of times that I think that I would have been just fine and dandy had I not found, if I found out later, it's one thing. And I think, you know, my dad was always very adventurous as far as having my sister and I try new foods. And we had gone to several, we lived in Europe for a couple of years, and I learned to eat duck and escargot and all kinds of things that most kids, calamari, that most kids don't eat. You know, how many kids do you know eat squid? I was, my sister and I love it, but you know, we weren't told this is squid. We were told, try this. It's called calamari. And, oh, this is good, especially with tomato sauce. So, you know, it's something. And my son likes calamari because you don't tell a child, try this, it's squid. Try this. This is called calamari. It's really good with tomato sauce. And so it's same with something like escargot. Escargot is harder because they always come in the snail shells itself. So, you know, lots of times I've asked for that. Don't bring me the snail shells. Just bring me the escargot.
But that's kind of cool. I would just love to try it, but like not know what I'm trying. Cause mm-hmm. It does sound interesting. Like the, I don't know if I've ever had any kind of animal brain to be honest with you, but if it tastes like noodles and it
was just a mushy noodle, and from a sustenance living aspect, you don't waste anything. You know, you don't waste parts of a moose. You know, when you get a moose, that's enough meat for a very long time, and you use all of it. You don't let any of it go to waste. You use the fur, you use the skin, you know, you use, that is what sustenance living is. And that's why those cultures lasted as long as they have. It's only when society has come in to try to help them that actually caused more harm. Yeah. Because they had their own education system. They had their own language. They had their own day-to-day lives. They weren't suffering. Were they given better tools? Yes, they were given better tools. But at the same time, they were given things that caused great harm. You know, Native Americans are not known to be able to hold their alcohol. And, you know, it's a problem. All across the country in Native American communities is the alcoholism, and their bodies can't handle it the way the white man, you know, Anglo-Saxon people can, just like tuberculosis. You don't hear of a lot of Anglo-Saxon people getting tuberculosis. The Native American population, it's a problem. Tuberculosis is a problem. There was no natural immunity to it the way it has built up in other heredity line. So you know, certain things that are a little different. So the Native American communities still are very strong. They're very connected to one another. And part of that goes back to their belief that we are all connected and we're connected to the earth. We're all connected to the animals. We're all connected through the seasons, and everything is cyclical. And all of that is, when you look at Aboriginal cultures across the globe that are in tune with nature, most of them are thriving communities, and they are very helpful to one another. You don't let anybody go hungry. You know, all of that is much more beneficial than the patriarchal society that we currently have across the globe, where half the population has very little influence in that, versus a lot of the Aboriginal communities, Native American communities are very matriarchal for different reasons. They're more in tune with the cycle. They're more in tune with understanding the natural rhythms of how the world works and how we as people work.
Yeah. I want to jump back really quick. The whole thing where you use like everybody, like if you catch a moose and like you use it at all, to put it into even another term, maybe that if somebody doesn't get the analogy, I guess, if you go to the store and get like a packaged meat, you cook the whole thing and you eat it instead of, like, I even eat the fats, like the fats, like I'll use it for flavor usually. Mm-hmm. and I eat it. I try to waste as little as I can, because
if you look at hunting was for a purpose at one point in time. You hunted to supplement your food. So if you go and deer hunting, which is still quite popular across the country, if you go deer hunting and you shoot a deer, what do you do with that? Now, you should, if you shoot the deer, go ahead and get the meat processed and take the meat home with you, or have the meat processed and donate it to a place so that other people can use that meat. But the American cultures use the skin. They use the stomach. I mean, all these things become, you know, stomachs are a great water bag. You know, because they don't have that ability to go ahead and rot because of the way the lining of the stomach and animals are. So using all of these things, you know, people don't like to hear it, but sausage is using the intestines of the animal to make the sausage. That's the sausage casing. And people, oh no, I cut that away and throw it away. Well, why? Why do you cut it away? You know, why do you throw it away? Because you know what it is? Because I promise you, the only reason you know what it is because somebody told you what it was, versus, you know, using it because it's the best way to go ahead and process some of that. So, you know, they used bones, you know, a lot of their artwork, especially in the Northwest Coast, a lot of the artwork was done on bone. You know, you had bone necklaces that were carved bone. You had miniature totem poles that were carved bone. Those things ended up being art or turned into tools or turned into fishing and needles and all that kind of stuff. So they learned to use all of the animal because they respected the animal. They didn't hunt to have fun. They hunted for survival. And when we turn and hunt for fun and not use and be thankful that we were able to kill this animal for our sustenance or sustenance of others, what is that saying about our reciprocity to the universe? And what are we giving back to others? What are we giving back for the cows that my husband and I buy half a cow at a time, and we go to a farm and we find somebody to take the other half because I can't eat that much beef in a year. It's all grass fed and organic, and we know the butcher and everything. So we know that our footprint for that. And they ask us, what do you want us to do with this? What do you want us to do? You know, do you want the hooves? How do you want this? Because there are certain things that per the FDA they can process and other things that they cannot. So from that perspective, we're obeying all that. But a lot of times taking the bones and just boiling them in water and getting the marrow out and everything, you know, is a good source of medicinal type broths that you can add to soups and stews and all of that kind of stuff. It's understanding that there's more from a cow than a McDonald's hamburger. And a lot healthier.
It's funny because like the brain is a crazy thing, because you mentioned, you know, the fact that them knowing is why that they don't want to eat it. But the funny thing to me is, if you think about the stuff that's like in our drinks and foods, and we don't know what a lot of it is. Like I could pick up this can right here, and I'm sure I could find something in the you know, little tiny thing that they put down there that I have no clue what it is, mm-hmm. but I still drink it, or I still, you know, eat it, or so it's just kind of, it's kind of funny that if you know, like if somebody like specifically tells you what that random word is, and now you know what it is, you're like,
well, look at Indiana Jones, Temple of Doom. Fabulous scene where they're eating, they're all eating, and finally somebody says it's monkey brains, and you know, people get all upset. But they were eating it and they were enjoying it before they knew what it was. You know, same with the bugs, because they showed it on the beetle shell and they're eating it off the beetle shell like you would a clam. You know, people eat what is local, and that's part of understanding what local cultures are. And in America specifically, we don't have that. We don't honor that. And when you go to different parts of the country and you go to Louisiana, you best have Creole while you're down there. You should try it, because that is something that is locally made. And whether it's from the sausages or from the shrimp or whatever, the massive spices that they use, and understand why they use the spices. The spices were to take bland foods and add flavor to it. You know, that's why in India you have so much curry, because a lot of their staple foods are unflavorful. Same with Southwest. Where do you think the chili pepper is so popular in the Southwest? There's lots of things, you know, if you look at tortillas, if you look at the different types of breads that are there in the Southwest, they're very plain, unflavorful, but they're sustenance. Tortillas are a sustenance. Pita bread is a sustenance in other parts of the world. So because of that, you have to find ways to spice things up to make things more tasty, especially when you're looking at cultures that may not have meat for a period of time. You know, when you got a moose and you went ahead and preserved as much of it as you could, whether you smoked it or whether there is a way to preserve the meat once it's smoked for an extended period. And when you do all that, I went to Fort Yukon, and when I went there, they brought out, we're in February, so it's the dead of winter. It is 52 degrees below zero with a wind chill that that made it like a 25 degree wind chill. So it was freezing. And I rode around on a dog sled, because that's how you get around, on a dog sled. And they brought out, they didn't really cook. They brought out what was called pilot bread, which is a cracker about this big. It's interesting because it's not a regular, it's not a saltine cracker. It's a little bit more filling, a little thicker. And I've never seen it anywhere but up in Alaska, pilot bread. And they brought out salmon pieces that I knew were smoked. They were in a liquid. And they brought out one jar, and we all shared the one jar. Now, later on, I realized that that was a feast, because they only have so much meat to get them through the winter. And we were an unexpected visit, and there was 8 of us total. So there was a lot of people that came to visit. So, you know, sustenance living still happens. And now they can get chicken there. I mean, they have a little grocery store and they can get chicken there, but they still are based on what they hunt, what they fish. Salmon, you know, salmon is a huge staple up there because they can fish all summer. But there is work to be done every year to go ahead and process a moose, process the salmon. But that is their main source of meat, or those two. Elk, they also have elk up there. But when you look at the different parts of the world, that there are certain foods that they're known for. Ireland's known for potatoes, yes. You know. Fish and chips in England. But there's a reason, because that was plentiful, and plentiful specifically for the poorer population.
So I have one last question, just because I'm generally curious. So in Alaska, during the colder months, is there like a specific type of clothing or something like that that they wear to stay warm? Because like, I know if you look at like, for example, Russia's culture, they have like the hats that mm-hmm. are like, cold, I forget what they're called, but they're, you know, you don't see them really in many other places. Mm-hmm. And then they all have the, like the fur clothing. Mm-hmm.
So prior to domestication, let's call it that. Prior to domestication, yes, they were wearing moose skin, elk skin, and they were using the fur. A lot of it was waterproofed and everything. And I have some pieces that my great grandmother made that, and they wore. I mean, that's what they wore. Now, no. And when I look at my cousin lives in Fort Yukon, she's a teacher there and has raised her two daughters there. And when I look at them running around in the wintertime, I think, God, you must be freezing. And she said, no. And part of it is they're used to it. They're wearing sweatshirts. They're wearing hats. They're wearing coats. But, you know, they're used to that. And when you are used to something, you know, interestingly enough, I'm originally from Pennsylvania and I live in Georgia. And when I go home to Pennsylvania in the summertime, I don't think it's all that hot in Pennsylvania in the summertime, where my dad talks about how hot it is all the time. But his temperature difference, you know, I'm most of the time in the summer in the 90s. In his summertime, it's in the low 80s. So to me, that's a cool morning. Because my mornings can start off at 78 degrees at 6 o'clock in the morning. And, you know, he doesn't have those type of temperatures. So you get used to where you live. And so she, you know, they're up there and they're used to that. Other people, like when I went up there, I had on long johns. I had on sweatpants under my jeans. And then I had a turtleneck, a long johns turtleneck, wool sweater. And then I had a parka that was for people to work outside at negative 10 degrees that I had specifically borrowed for that trip. And I was still cold because my little body could not, it's not meant to be in the cold.
I mean, that makes a lot of sense too. I've lived in Ohio all my life. I have a friend that's from Texas. And when he would come up here, he would be in like a winter jacket, and I'm looking at him like, because it's like I prefer like the 60s, and that's when he was around mm-hmm. here personally. That's when I feel the most comfortable. And he was like, it's freezing. And I was like, mm-hmm. now? Yeah. So yeah, that does make a lot of sense.
What you get accustomed to.
But that's kind of, I don't know, just the brain and the body, it's an interesting thing, because mm-hmm. I feel like it does have a lot of effects on things, especially like in terms of our environment and stuff. Mm-hmm. It learns to cope.
Yep, it does.
Well, thank you for coming on. I really enjoyed chatting with you. Do you have any like final like thoughts that you might want to throw out there? Like if you have anything coming up, or if somebody wanted to book you for like life coach or anything like that?
Absolutely. Thank you very much, Jana, for having me on your show. I enjoyed our conversation. The audience can reach me at terrykozlowski.com, and I'll be happy to send to you a free, we talked briefly about personal boundaries. I have a free checklist to see if you are maintaining your personal boundaries, because I just launched a course, a guide to setting personal boundaries and not allowing drama into your life. And it's on mastermind.com. So I'll provide that link as well. And that way your audience can learn. It's one of the crucial steps in my trauma recovery. And I outlined it in the book, Raven Transcending Fear, that personal boundaries really do help us to learn self-care, learn to be able to keep other people's drama out of our lives when we're wanting to people please, when we're wanting to be feel accepted, when our egoic mind is saying, oh no, you need to help them move, even though you've already planned your vacation. You need to go stop, you know, cancel your vacation and go help them. No, you need to go on vacation. They'll understand. If they truly love and care about you, they will understand that you going on vacation that was already planned. It's one thing if you say, oh no, I better plan that vacation so I don't have to go. That's different. But if you've already had a planned vacation, then, you know, learning how to set those personal boundaries and as a part of your self-care and act of self-love is really important for all of us, because that's not something we're taught as kids. That's something that, you know, we struggle with because we want that acceptance, or the egoic mind wants that acceptance. Your authentic self, your soulful self, knows it's worthy just as it is, and knows that those people that are meant to love and be a part of your life will love and accept you exactly the way you are. And you don't need to change for them. You don't need to, you know, do anything extra but be. And that's what the human being means, is that we're supposed to be. It's not human doing, it's human being.